The Brewers are back in town, which means it's time for a new Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Brewers podcast. I'm Matt Velasquez, and I'm here with beat reporters Tom Hodricourt and Todd Rosiak. Since the last time we talked, the Brewers went 8-8, and first baseman Eric Thames became the talk of the major leagues, mashing 7 homers with 12 RBI and putting together a .408 average. Guys, have you seen anything like this stretch?
Well, I've been covering the Brewers a lot longer than Todd, so I'm guessing I have seen things similar to this, but it's historically noted that Jeremy Burnett is the only Brewer to ever homer in 5 straight games, which Thames did. So we've only seen something like that once before, if you were around to even see that. So it's just pretty extraordinary, the tear that he was on. If he wasn't homering, he was doubling or walking, and they basically just couldn't get him out. And I think what makes it extraordinary is that after playing 3 years in Korea and having very modest spring training numbers, we just figured it'd take him a while to work into things. So, yeah, it took him like a few games. And that's what's extraordinary, I think, is just that you don't see it coming right away like it has.
You know, and Todd, you covered the last road trip where Thames, kept his streak going and kept, being hot at the plate against the Cubs. What did you see as you were covering that tear?
Since he came into Chicago already on that tear, it started in Cincinnati. I wasn't on that portion, so this was my first chance in Chicago to see him up close. Since he really started tearing the cover off the ball, and it's interesting to watch his at bats. He's a very cerebral guy, and he talks frequently about visualization and his goal being putting together great at bats every time in there. And you watch him more closely, and you see that it's a guy that just does not like to give anything away. And yesterday, went 0 for 2, but he walked 3 times, so he's on base 3 more times. He's not, he didn't get a hit, but he was still impacting the game, in a positive way for the Brewers. And even the at-bats that he had that he didn't get hits, I believe he had a 9-pitch at-bat once, and that was with the bases loaded, where he could have broken the game open for the Brewers, and ultimately they needed that. But it's just been very interesting to watch him, all the different parts that have come together for him. And also being down there as he was kind of in the midst of it, especially that Monday game where he hit the home run, just the, all the attention that's been focused on him, a couple national columnists were down there. He was doing all kinds of things with, MLB Network and all that kind of stuff. And, just watching him handle that, it's got to be pretty amazing for a guy who, really was nobody knew who he was last year at this time, as he was killing it in Korea, and now he's one of the biggest stories in the major league. So it's been fun to watch, and just from our interactions with him, he's a good dude and very, very good interview. So from a journalist standpoint, I can speak for Tom too in saying that we've really enjoyed watching this and enjoyed working with him so far.
Yeah, and Todd, obviously he can't keep up these crazy numbers that he has, but what are some reasonable expectations for what he can do over the course of the rest of the season?
You see all kinds of different projections, the Stathead projections, if you want to say, the ones that I've seen, they're all pretty optimistic. Like you said, obviously he's not going to hit .400. He's not going to, hit 70 home runs or anything like that. But, we had talked in the spring amongst ourselves about, what would be, reasonable expectations for him, for the Brewers. And just generally speaking, I think we all kind of agreed that, like a .275 average, 15 to 20 homers, 75 RBI, we would consider that a really good year. And with the way he started now, maybe we have to rethink those. Maybe we were being too conservative. Obviously, it's a long season. We're only a little bit more than 2 weeks in. And, pitchers are going to adjust. The book isn't going to get out on him. And then the pressure is going to be on him to respond to that. As he told us the other day after Monday's game, that it's just a big cat and mouse game with the pitchers, and it's on him to adjust and watch video and continue to do the visualization and do the work that he needs to do to stay hot. But I don't know. It's just going to be fun to watch to see what, you know, if he can go on a similar tear like this moving forward. You know, could 30, 35 homers be out of the realm of possibility? 100 RBI. It's not looking like it now. You know, and for a position that was really a black hole for the Brewers, first base, for several years. You know, obviously Chris Carter had a good power year last year, but you know, maybe this is a guy that's going to solidify that spot for, you know, 3-4 years to come.
Yeah. And, you know, in the first podcast we had, Tom, we were talking about, you know, Jesus Aguilar and what he could be at first base. So what does the rise of the player nicknamed God in Korea mean for the guy you called Babe Aguilar?
Yeah, well, obviously it's going to mean less playing time for him because Craig Counsell was looking for ways to get Aguilar at bats, and he was putting Thames in the outfield a little bit and also sitting him against lefties. Well, so far it looks like you don't have to sit him against lefties because Thames has been hitting lefties very well, including a few home runs. So who knows? I mean, Aguilar was supposed to be a bench player anyway, and you know, Craig Counsell has a way of getting at bats for all of his players. He calls them his position player group. And I noted that Aguilar in the last game in Chicago pinch hit and walked. That's a very good sign because you know the temptation is to swing away when you haven't been getting much playing time, and instead he showed good plate discipline. And both of these guys, Aguilar and Thames, looked like they have good eyes at the plate. You know, Todd just mentioned Chris Carter, and he was an all or nothing player. He tied for the home run lead in the National League last year, but he also led the league in strikeouts. And there was very few and far between other than striking out and hitting home runs. And so now you have two guys, Aguilar and Thames, who just show way better eyes at the plate and have better OBPs. The thing that's really impressive about Thames is his slugging stats were off the charts in Korea, but his OBP was unbelievable too. He's like over 400 OBP. So when he's not hitting home runs, he gets on base.
Yeah, and that's obviously something that, you know, when you're looking at the analytics and you say, hey, we have to keep an eye on this guy, you know, those numbers pop off the page. You know, so now that we've kind of covered the Thames angle, you know, a little bit, you know, I'll go to each of you and kind of, you know, ask you, over the first 16 games, kind of what has stood out to you besides Eric Thames? I guess, Todd, we can go to you first.
You're putting me on the spot here. I wrote a little bit about it. In today's paper, but I guess I'll take the negative part. The start of Jonathan Villar has really jumped out to me. You know, there's a guy that everybody was expecting to kind of take that next step and, you know, making that position switch to second base. I don't think many people thought it was going to be much of an issue for him. And he's just started off very poorly. He's striking out at a very high rate. Not getting on base, just looks lost at the plate right now. And then you mix in the fact that he's had quite a few struggles defensively at second base, you know, hanging on to the ball, you know, kind of, you know, making bad flips, losing the ball in the exchanges, that sort of thing, and making the same kinds of base running mistakes that he did last year. You know, makes you wonder, did he learn anything from last year and all the struggles that he had running the bases, even though he led the major leagues in stolen bases. So, obviously, again, it's very early. There's plenty of time for him to turn it around. But you know, this is a guy that missed a good portion of spring training, taking part in the WBC, wound up not playing really. And maybe that time that he missed really kind of set him back because he's off to a really bad start. And as a guy who's hitting leadoff for this team, he's supposed to set the table, set the tone, and he's really not doing that at this point.
Yeah. On one other factor with VR, Todd and Matt is, you know, he was offered an extension in spring training for reported $20 million. The team never confirmed stuff like that. but it obviously happened because we got comments that, you know, from both parties that made it, you know, certain that, that something was going on. And it was, and he turned it down. They were trying to buy out some arbitration years and, maybe perhaps a year of, non, you know, moving past arbitration, and he turned it down, in essence, betting on himself to continue to have productive years. And are we seeing Casey McGee and Gene Segura, you know, repeats here? Those are players that turned down extensions after having early success and then pressed to show they were worth more and ended up failing and getting traded. So, you know, is that going on in the back of his mind too, that he's putting pressure on himself to show he's worth more than he was offered? You never know. They would never admit it. And there is a little bit of a language barrier with VR. Who knows? It's probably, maybe it's all of those things. But he has not looked good, as Todd mentioned, since he got back from the WBC, where he sat on the bench for 2 weeks. And for that matter, neither has Hernan Perez, so, who also sat on the bench during WBC. So I just wonder, the next time the WBC rolls around, when guys asked to go play for their countries, if the Brewers are going to find out first, are you going to play or just sit around?
To jump in here a little bit too, you know, we talked yesterday at the game about, or before the game with Craig Counsell, about the lineup and just how it's kind of been a lineup of extremes. You know, on one end, you've got Eric Thames, you've got Ryan Braun, guys like that. Travis Shaw's been hitting for power. And then on the flip side, you've got the guys like VR. Keon Broxton looks like the Keon Broxton of last year at this time, where he just couldn't make contact, striking out every time he's up. Orlando Arcia. So you've got the extremes, the guys going really well at one end, and you've got the guys who are really struggling on the other end, and no middle ground, which makes for, it can create difficulties in scoring runs. And obviously scoring runs is the name of the game here. And you saw that in Chicago, two games that the Brewers lost, both times they got out to, early leads, and both times those leads fizzled away, largely because the guys that have been hot, you know, you can't expect those guys to carry the offense every single night. And when you get to that bottom part of the order, it's pretty much game over, nothing happening.
They've been kind of home run or bust with their runs too. They had a few rallies in Chicago where they had some doubles and hits, but they've been largely reliant on home runs to score so far, and I don't think we saw that coming either. But if you live by the long ball, you die by the long ball too. It's hard to sustain that type of offense, especially with, as Todd noted, when half the lineup's not doing anything. That makes the other guys have to hit all the home runs, and it's just hard to keep relying on home runs for offense. And like I said, I don't think we saw that coming. We didn't consider this to be like a big slugging team, but right now that's how they've been. You know, a large part of their offense has been on home runs.
You know, and so far, you know, through 16 games, we've taken three turns through the rotation, and the Brewers lost Junior Guerra on opening day. You know, how would you guys assess the Brewers pitching, you know, just through these first 16 games?
Well, it's Jimmy Nelson struggled in Chicago, the 3, 4, and 5 pitchers, Peralta, Anderson, and Nelson have been fantastic. So it just goes to show you, no matter how you line them up, it doesn't necessarily mean that the number one guy is going to be better than the number five guy. It depends on the makeup of the rotation. And as you noted, they did lose Junior Guerra right out of the chute. Tommy Malone had an encouraging start yesterday, Wednesday in Chicago. So they're still waiting for Zach Davies to find his pinpoint command. That's what makes him special. Took a little baby step forward in Cincinnati the other day, was a little bit better, but he hasn't been sharp like he can be when he just carves up hitters with precision pitching. And then, you know, we've got the decision looming here in the next few days with Matt Garza, you know, supposedly ready to come back to the rotation. Are they going to put him in? If they do, who's going out? So it's going to be decision time here soon on one of those spots.
I'll jump in. The back end of the bullpen has been fun to watch. I mean, let's take yesterday's Wednesday's game out of the mix. Obviously, that was not so much fun for Brewer fans, but you know, when was the last time the Brewers had a back end of a bullpen with three guys touching, you know, 100 or close to it? You know, Jacob Barnes has been unbelievable since spring training, and who could have called that one? You know, he looked not very good, let's just say, in spring training, especially late, and he's certainly gotten himself back on track. Tom wrote a good, interesting column about that whole deal last week, but you know, Corey Knebel, Neftali Feliz, you've got three power arms there in the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning when the Brewers had the lead late, and it's been a while since they've had that kind of talent and that kind of velocity. And obviously, it's not always going to translate. Yesterday, Corey Knebel and Neftali Feliz both struggled, and it wound up costing the Brewers the game. But by and large, I think any manager would agree you'd much rather have guys who are throwing high 90s, because it gives you more of you know, more leeway and more margin for error when you do miss on a pitch. And I know it's fans also get a kick out of watching those velocities on the TV screen. And when you see a guy like Jacob Barnes hit 100 like he did on Monday, that's pretty eye popping for sure.
You know, and Todd, kind of you mentioned that blown opportunity on Wednesday against the Cubs, and that came immediately on the heels of letting another game slip away on Tuesday. You know, so the Brewers finished with a 6-3 road trip, but they were in the driver's seat and had the opportunity to possibly go 8-1 with a possible sweep of the Cubs. You know, what does it mean going forward that they let those two games slip away to end the road trip kind of on a sour note when it was otherwise a very positive road trip?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I touched on in the story today, is just that it sounds funny when you say that a 6-3 road trip is kind of disappointing, but you know, to me, I think it is, just from the standpoint that they very well could have been and probably should have been 8-1 off of that road trip, and who would have guessed that before you know, before they headed out to onto it last week. They still played some pretty good ball overall and did some good things, and Craig Counsell talked before Wednesday's game just about the value of a good opening road trip like they had. You know, all things considered, still 6-3 is good. It was a winning road trip. You know, the thing that Craig Counsell always looks at are his guys playing hard, and are they playing intelligently? And I think for the most part, you can say the Brewers did that. Obviously, the execution was lacking those last two games in Chicago, and it cost them wins both times. But, you know, I think if you would have said the Brewers are going to go 6-3 heading into that first road trip, most fans would have taken that.
Yeah, and Tom, does it, you know, it's early in the season, does it mean anything that they're playing so well on the road compared to at home? You know, 2-5 to start season at home, is that just kind of, you know, matchups and fluky, or does that mean anything?
Well, we'll know better as we move along. We've had one homestand and one road trip. The homestand wasn't so great, and the road trip was mostly good. So we'll see. You know, one thing that I was thinking about the other day in that regard is so many of these players are inexperienced, and so Miller Park isn't a whole lot more comfortable to him yet than it is on the road, you know, and it's not like they have the team that they did have before they started tearing it down was a veteran team, and all of them had been at Miller Park for some time, and probably it felt like a pair of nice comfy slippers for them. It was just very comfortable, but these guys, a lot of them are just, you know, have only been at Miller Park for one homestand, you know. Thames has only been there for one homestand. Aguilar, you know, Shaw, a lot of these, and then a lot of them have only been there a year, you know, or less than a year. So, I mean, who knows with such an inexperienced team how that's going to pan out. We've seen them have good years at Miller Park and bad years with both veteran and inexperienced teams. So there a lot of it is kind of a crapshoot, who you're playing, when you're hot. You know, they went to Toronto, and Toronto had been off to a dreadful start, And so they caught them at the right time. Cincinnati was like 7-2 and not that good. So they were due to lose some games. And then the Cubs are the best team in baseball. So I know there's some disappointment from Brewers fans that they let both of those last two games get away. But I mean, they weren't playing a bunch of stumble bums. Those, you know, getting through that lineup is easier said than done. And they just foul off so many good pitches until they get what they want. So they played. Yeah, you know, they played the Cubs twice now and gone 1-2 against them both times. Well, I think if you think about where the Brewers are in their rebuild and the fact that the Cubs are coming off 103 wins and a World Series title, that's probably about what you would expect.
Yeah, and when it comes to that opening homestand, you know, three of those games were against the Cubs. I wasn't there. How much of a home feel did Miller Park have in those three games? And I would assume the Cubs fans traveled pretty well.
Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous. It's been interesting. You know, obviously there's always going to be that enmity between Brewers fans and Cubs fans. And, you know, the Cubs fans used to take over Miller Park. And then when the Cubs got into their rebuild, well, it wasn't so much the case anymore. But now that the Cubs are world champions and they're playing well, obviously it's taken another swing. And, you know, Tom could comment on this too, but it's, man, that first series there last weekend had to have been about 85% Cubs fans there, it sounded like. I mean, it was pretty much like a Chicago home game. And, you know, I know I've talked to some fans and heard from some fans who were very frustrated with all that. And, I would just say it's to be expected. You know, that's been the case since interleague play started, really. You know those fans are going to come up. They're dedicated, they're loyal, and that's just kind of the way it is. I guess if you're a Brewer fan, you got to try to cheer louder.
You know, and so
I'll just chime in on that too. That Saturday night game against the Cubs I covered, there was just hardly. It seemed like there were. Well, let's put it this way. Chris Bryant had a 2-run double, and it looked like the whole ballpark stood up and cheered. I mean, I know there were some Brewers fans in there, but not many. And like Todd said, we've spoken to a couple of Brewers fans who were just totally surrounded by Cubs fans and were not, you know, not excited about that. So, I remarked after that weekend series in Milwaukee that the Cubs had already played a home series before they opened at Wrigley. They, you know, came home and gave out their rings and had like a, three-day celebration of their World Series championship. But they had just as many Cubs fans in Miller Park before they went home to Wrigley. So, you know, that may eventually, when the Brewers get good again, Brewers fans may stop selling their tickets to Cubs fans. But right now, with a rebuilding club and with the Brewers charging more for their so-called marquee series, it probably makes more sense to Brewers fans to sell their tickets, make a lot of money, and then just watch the games on television, you know, until the team's good again. You don't like to see that, and you wish that the Brewers season ticket holders, you know, would be more loyal to their team, but you sort of understand them doing that.
Speaking of World Series rings, Tom, I was fortunate enough to see Jason Carr's ring up close on Wednesday at Wrigley Field. Jason Carr is the Cubs PR director. And, oh my gosh, talk about ridiculous. You know, a lot was made about the Cubs winning the World Series and everything. And it's clear the Ricketts family spared no expense when it came to the hardware, because this thing felt like it weighed about 2 pounds. And, you know, he told me that it has 108 diamonds in it, which of course is for the, you know, the years. 5.5 total carats worth of diamonds. Got some rubies in it, some blue stones, spelling out the W for the W flag. Really, really ridiculous, but, you know, it's, obviously to the victors go the spoils, and that's a pretty nice spoil to have.
Well, one thing that, I didn't understand, Todd, about those, World Series rings was didn't they have the slogan on the back of the ring, "We never quit"?
Yep, they had that slogan on the inside of the band too. It also had a goat.
Well, I get the goat because of the history of the goat, but I think their motto that most people remembered is "Try not to suck."
We actually said that to Jason. We said, "Well, we were surprised that was not on there," and he laughed.
But I don't get the "we never quit" because have any World Series champions ever quit?
Please. Are you serious?
But I don't get it. It's like that goes under the no, you know what, Sherlock category. Oh, you didn't quit? Oh, we thought maybe you quit.
Jason said that that was kind of an inside the Beltway Cubs thing from last year. That was kind of an inside the clubhouse team slogan. So that was the meaning behind that. It was something that the team itself and the coaching staff and the support staff was all about. So that's why
it just seems a little stilted, you know. And like I said, have any World Series teams ever not quit? It'd be great to say their slogan should have been "We tried to quit, but we weren't successful."
I don't know if that would have fit on the rings. Maybe it might be too long.
Well, they put everything else on there, it sounds like, but the kitchen sink. I guess it was good to bank 108 years of funds to buy rings because when they went all out when they had one. And plus they gave everybody one. Todd, didn't they even pick out like 20 fans and give them rings? Some symbolic, you had a way of, I don't know, applying for them or getting in some type of contest for them, but they even, wanted the symbolism of having some fans get rings too. And so they gave a lot of them out. They probably gave out more rings than any team that's ever won gave out.
The story I read said the Ricketts family gave out 1,908 rings and pins. So, of course, they picked up everything, including the taxes, because you know you have to pay taxes on those as gifts, apparently. And of course, there's a tier, the people who are the players and the coaches and the front office staff, like Theo Epstein, are going to get the real expensive rings, and then as you trickle down, the quote unquote less important people will get the less expensive trinkets. But still, anything is cool. And they also had to sign, apparently everybody except the players and coaches had to sign agreements when they got them from the Cubs saying that if they ever sold the rings or their pin or whatever they got, they had to offer it back to the Cubs first. The Cubs are just trying to head off people taking these things out to market right away and selling them. I read in that story there was a memorabilia broker who was quoted as saying that even a mid-level player if a mid-level player from that World Series team would decide to sell his ring, I don't know, let's say like Justin Grimm or something, just for argument's sake, he was guessing the market would begin around $80,000 for a ring if you were to sell it. So it just kind of gives you an idea of how nuts people go for the Cubs and them winning the World Series for the first time in forever.
Wow. And so kind of sticking kind of with the Cubs, but not exactly, every podcast we're going to try and give people a look at kind of how you guys do your jobs and what it's like behind the scenes covering the team. And so, with this being the first road trip that you guys just finished up, I wanted to figure out how you guys plan for those road trips. Do you do the whole season at once? Sitting down with a big schedule, in February or March, while you're at spring training, do you kind of pick and choose? How do you decide who goes where?
Flip a coin.
Well, let's just say that travel within the NL Central has become problematic airline-wise. So we're pretty far into this podcast, so we won't kill a bunch of time just talking about how the difficulties of travel. It's just gotten harder to find decent ways to get to the cities within the division, and you go to those cities more than you do other cities. So Todd and I try to split those up so that we're equally miserable in our travel. But especially like to Pittsburgh, where there's no direct flights and you have to go through, Saskatchewan to get to Pittsburgh. So we try to even out some of the badness of travel. But then we look at special requests too. If there's Todd's been good about letting me go to Washington because I have family down there, and he's had a family that he's seen in San Francisco. And then we try to even out weekends. You want to be able to have some weekends at home, even though baseball season is kind of during, you know, summer holiday season. So it's just kind of like that. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a crapshoot, but we try to be fair with each other.
For me, I'm not like Tom. I haven't been around for 11-9 years, so I'm still working on getting to all the ballparks, and I'm down to, I think, 4 or 5 I need to get to. And every year when the schedule comes out, that's the first thing I always look at is, are there any trips that I need to go on to knock a ballpark off my list? This year, the only one was going to be Yankee Stadium, but because of the way the schedule is working out up to that point for both of us, I was told Tom it was going to be easier for Tom to do that trip, so I was fine with that. I'm sure at some point I'll get to Yankee Stadium. I'm not really worried about it, but that's just my big thing, my personal thing, trying to get to all the ballparks at least once. And I'm pretty close, so I can't really complain. You know, maybe we can save the discussion of what our favorite ballparks are for another time. But yeah, we've kind of got it down to a science. We'll start talking about how we want to split things up during spring training, and we did that again this year, and we got through, I think, a little bit past the All-Star break, and then we'll reconvene on it later and finish out the rest of the season. So, you know, planning in advance obviously allows us to, you know, line up the airline tickets and you know, get our hotels and everything in order. You know, we're obviously being cost conscious and trying to save the company money as much as possible. So that factors into planning it out early as well. That's pretty much it. Nothing really scientific to it, other than just trying to figure out what works best for both of us and trying to be amenable.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, Todd, you, in the eyes of most fans, you drew the lucky straw and got to, you know, go to Wrigley first. You know, though, from what I hear, Wrigley isn't always the best when it comes to covering a game. How's that work over, you know, down there?
Yeah, real lucky going down there. And let me preface this all by saying that I realize that what we're doing, most people would kill to do, and I'm certainly not asking people to feel sorry for us. But, you know, from a work standpoint, covering a game at Wrigley is about as bad as it gets. Everything about it is annoying, from getting to the ballpark, getting in the ballpark. There's only one functioning elevator, and it's down the left field line. So it doesn't really do us any good when we're trying to do our job. The press box is antiquated, and it's either freezing cold when it's cold out, or it's boiling hot in the summer when it's very hot. There's no air conditioning. The visiting clubhouse is, in a word, atrocious. It blows my mind that Major League Baseball has allowed that to be a Major League clubhouse of any sort for however many years it's been. And I'm not joking when I tell you that there are junior high school locker rooms that are better than the visiting clubhouse at Wrigley Field. It's small, it's cramped, it smells, it's gross, it's just everything possible, every negative thing, that's what it is. And it makes everybody's jobs difficult, from the players to the coaching staff to the media, because you're just bumping into everybody. There's no room to maneuver. People would be blown away if they saw it.
It's so cramped, Matt, that the Brewers habitually bring Craig Counsell and request the players down the steps and into this tunnel-like hallway, echo chamber, because we can't. As small as the Milwaukee media is, they don't have room for us to go into the clubhouse without tripping all over each other. Think alliteration, because I'm going to have to modify one of the words. Curtis Leskanic once told me it was the only clubhouse where you can poop. He didn't say poop. Think alliteration. He said poop, shower, and shave, and not leave your locker.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they've made, with the improvements there, they actually have added in a workout area now, which is kind of in this long winding tunnel that goes from the clubhouse to the dugout, which eliminated their old workout area, which literally was an exercise bike in the north end of the clubhouse. And the players used to jokingly put athletic tape around this bike, you know, and call it the workout room. And that's really all it was, one exercise bike. So a guy could sit on there and loosen up a little bit, and that was it. So that's a joke. And then, you know, for us, for our purposes, the biggest thing is being able to get upstairs and downstairs quickly. Well, there's no press elevator, which means when the final pitch is thrown, the game is over, we have to quickly file our stories, and then we have to run downstairs to the clubhouse along with the 45,000 other fans who are trying to leave at the same time. And as anybody who's gone to Wrigley knows, the concourses are not exactly spacious. The ramps are not exactly spacious. So you very often are running down the ramps, body surfing. It's like going through a busy night at Summerfest. You're crammed in there with a bunch of other people, and you're going where the crowd's taking you. And there's been several times where, you know, Ron Renicki or Craig Council have had to hold off on starting their post-game remarks because we're still trying to get down to the clubhouse. And there's just no fast way or easy way to do it. So all those things put together add up for a really annoying experience. And doing that, 9, 10, 11 times a year down there, it's not fun. It's one of really my least favorite trip out of anyone to take in baseball.
We just have to remember, you know, it was built over 100 years ago when we didn't have reporters trying to get stuff online and, you know, making crazy deadlines and stuff like that. It was back in those days. It was probably a couple of daily newspapers covering them. No radio or TV, maybe a little radio. And so it just wasn't an issue. You had all day, you know, to file your copy. It was only going in the newspaper. There were no online stuff, no social media, none of that stuff. So it has no amenities because of when it was built. And they're trying bit by bit to redo the ballpark, but they haven't got to the press box yet, and they haven't got to the visiting clubhouse yet. Shockingly, the media and the visiting ballplayers are at the bottom of the take care of list. And so I told Todd, the only way they're going to help us is if they can put a human-sized pneumatic tube from the clubhouse to the press box and just shoot us down there in a big air, you know, swoosh of air. That'd be the only way that would help us. So even when they do remodel the press box and the clubhouse, it's still going to be hard to get to it because you got to go through all the stands and the fan traffic. But that's, if you're going to stick with but Fenway Park has similar issues. If you're going to stick with a 100-plus-year-old ballpark, you're not going to have the modern amenities. So you just got to – at least we only have to do it a few times a year. The reporters that cover the team have to do it 81 times a year.
That's true. So, you know, someone always has it worse off. So, you know, let's look ahead a little bit before we wrap up. You know, our next podcast will be a ways down the road, considering the Brewers have a 10-game homestand, and then they're on the road for about a week. So the next time we'll talk will be either May 8th or May 9th, since the Brewers are coming home again on May 9th. So kind of let's look ahead mostly at the 10-game homestand that the Brewers have to close out the month. They have four against the Cardinals, three against the Reds, an off day, and then three at home against the Braves. So, you know, kind of what are you guys expecting from this 10-game homestand?
That off day is going to be welcome, I think, by everybody, because they will have played 16 in a row at that point, and I think 23 out of 24. It's been a very unusual April schedule. Usually there's a lot of off days built into April because of expected, you know, crummy weather, but the Brewers have not had – they've just had one off day so far and that one coming. You know, the Cardinals have traditionally played well at Miller Park. They're facing some pitchers that they don't usually do well against, Carlos Martinez and Adam Wainwright, pitchers like that. And so we'll see how they do it. The Cardinals are – I was looking at their lineup, they don't have hardly anybody hot. You know, we were talking about how the Brewers have some hot, some cold. The Cardinals don't have hardly any hot hitters, yet they just swept Pittsburgh with 3 straight 2-1 wins. I mean, when have you ever heard of that? You know, 3 straight 2. So they're squeaking by on their pitching to stay relevant. And then, you know, Cincinnati, they just played Cincinnati. They're in a similar rebuilding mode. And the Braves are kind of a rebuilding team, too, although they probably have the oldest starting rotation in history with Bartolo Colon and R.A. Dickey and people like that. So going to be an interesting homestand and a long one. I think tied for their longest homestand of the year.
Scooter Gennett comes back to Miller Park, too, obviously, with the Reds in town. So not a huge thing, but always – it should be interesting to see the reaction he gets.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, so that'll be that homestand, a 7-game road trip, and then we'll talk again. Before we wrap up, we do have one question on Twitter for you guys. It comes from Shane Flavin. I'm not sure how to pronounce that one, but he just says the little things continue to plague this team. You know, situational hitting and base running. You know, for example, you know, is this mental by the players or is it coaching?
Well, they played 16 games, so a tenth of their schedule. So I don't know. Let's not, you know, say anything set in stone yet. You know, little things are what wins games. But you know, they did a better job on that road trip of doing the little things. But they mostly did a lot of big things, like hit home runs. So it's you rebuild and you have growing pains with the rebuilding team. So it's going to be erratic. They're not ready to be consistent yet. They're a long ways from being consistent yet because they're so inexperienced and they're just breaking in a whole lot of new players. So I'm not going to put a whole lot of credence to any so-called trend yet because we're just getting going.
And I always laugh at the coaching thing. These guys spend more time talking to players, working with players, looking at video, looking at scouting reports, passing that information along to the players. I mean, that's their job. That's what these guys do. So maybe the question is, are they passing it along in a easily digestible way? I don't know, but I mean, these coaches, I don't think you can, and you can say this about any staff. I mean, that's what these guys' jobs are, is to pass along information to players and get them playing at an optimal level. And, you don't think that, Craig Counsell is talking to Jonathan Villar on a regular basis about his base running or, you know, impressing upon him the fact that he needs to be smarter on the base pass? Of course. I mean, it happens all the time. It's on the player to implement that. It's just like, you know, why did a pitcher throw a guy, you know, a knee-high fastball that he could crush out of the park to end the game like yesterday? Well, obviously that's not the scouting report. You know, the pitcher needs to execute and put the pitch where it's supposed to be. He didn't do it. There you see the result. So the coaching is being done. These guys are being given the information. These guys are being told what to do. It's on the guys to implement that and to do what they're supposed to do. So that's the biggest thing, you know. Craig Counsell is going to give these guys opportunities to make mistakes. He keeps talking about how young these guys are, and he's got a point, you know, and he wants them to be aggressive. He wants to test the limits. But again, at some point, there has to be a cutoff point, and how many more mistakes do you let Jonathan Villar make? We'll see. But that's a guy that they've obviously, centered in on as a potential building piece. So you let him play and you let him work through those things.
All right. Well, with that, you know, I think we've wrapped up the second episode of the Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast. As always, you can find our latest episodes on JS Online. You can also find them on our Audio Boom page. You can also subscribe using iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Apparently, we're on the TuneIn app, so we're in a lot of places. You can find us, you know, basically everywhere you get podcasts. So, as I mentioned, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you guys again in May.